Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the first Sunday brunch of 2019 here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up on today's programme, we embrace one of broadcasting's toughest challenges. We discuss mime on the radio as a dedicated festival begins here in London. Also coming up, it may be dry January for many, but we buck the trend and stock the Monocle drinks cabinet with some apple brandy. Plus, with more and more people falling in love with classical music, we meet a collective getting reactions like this to the cello.
We finished this piece, you know, and it's like you've just been hit by a tidal wave. And this guy in the front row just stood up and was like, "That was fucking awesome!"
And the writer Ivy Pachoda talks about her latest novel.
It's a homeless community where you see traditional homeless lifestyle, people sleeping and camping on the streets, but there's also a great sense of community and joy there that I think a lot of people overlook. So I was interested in examining these two sort of misunderstood places.
And I'll be joined in the studio by the journalist Vincent McAvinney. He'll be going through the weekend papers with me. All that to come this hour live from London with me, Emma Nelson, on Monocle 24. So to begin the first show of 2019, we set ourselves a little bit of a challenge. Mime on the radio. It's an art form we don't see that much of in the mainstream media, but it is by all accounts thriving. And this week sees the launch of the London International Mime Festival. It's an event which has been described as one that constantly tempts us out of our comfort zone. As part of the festival, Theatre Re will be presenting the world premiere of their latest work called Birth. And to tell me a little bit more about everything I've just mentioned, I'm delighted to say Guillaume Piget, who's company director of Theatre Re, joins me in the studio. Happy New Year and welcome to the studio, Guillaume.
Hello, Emma. Thank you for having me.
Before we started and sort of introducing ourselves and what we do, I sort of wanted to know a little bit about what exactly mime was, because I think a lot of us have a certain idea in our heads what it might well be, and I'm not sure whether you're going to say we could do a little bit better.
Yeah, well, it's a big question. What is it? I think, I mean, obviously, as soon as you say the word mime, people imagine, you know, someone wearing gloves and being stuck in a box. But to me, mime is about making metaphors. It's about making something visible that is actually not visible. It's about communication, but you know, through movement, through images, through visuals, through actions, rather than just words.
Is this effectively a fresh and different way of telling stories?
I don't think it's new, because it's been going on for years. You know, it goes back to ancient Greek when we've got accounts of the first, you know, mime shows, if you like. So I don't think it's new. I just think it's just rediscovering the terms. Obviously, you know, Marcel was just so famous in the later part of the 20th century that it sort of captured everything. But physical expression, visual expression, the ability to communicate through actions rather than appearances, for instance, you know, it's been going on for years, so it's not a new thing. It's a rediscovery of what actually can mean.
It's a new thing, but the way you describe it, it's really hard to describe a little bit. I mean, before we came on air, we were talking about what we could compare it to in music, and people like to categorise rock, punk, classical, dance music, and you are a fan of one thing and not of the other in many ways, although later in the programme we'll see how all that's changing a little bit. Do you think mime suffers a little bit from that, insofar as, I think somewhere on describing your company, there's someone who's saying that mimers must have the body of a gymnast, the mind of an actor and the heart of a poet, which means that you can be everything but you can't be one.
I think there's several good in what you're saying. I think the comparison with music is extremely important. I don't know anyone on the planet who is not touched by music, and yet it's the most. You know, everything is calculated, everything is measured, and there are seven notes in total, and yet you can play the whole range of human emotions, and I think it's similar with mime. There is that, you know, there is that sense of craft, there is that sense of having to really own your craft, but at the same time, and it might, you know, when you train, it might seem a little bit clinical, but then when you start putting it together and creating a production, then you realise actually you can play that range. And then we, you know, it's about imagining the body of the actor a little bit like a keyboard, and you learn how to play the different notes, and then you put them together, and I think you're able to reach that range, is that just that it's a little less known.
So when we come to a theatre reproduction, what do we see when we see a body being turned into a keyboard?
Hopefully you don't see that. Hopefully the craft is hidden, because, you know, it should not be seen. If you come to the show and you're like, oh, well, these guys, they've trained really well, they're brilliant, then I think we've missed the point. I think the idea is that you don't see it. It's not seen, and you're being taken on a journey. And that journey can be a story, but it doesn't have to be. It can be an emotion. It can be the portrayal of a state of mind. It can be anything, and maybe none of what I've mentioned. The idea is that you transport the audience and you take them somewhere else, somewhere new, somewhere that where they've never been before, and then they come out of the theatre and they're changed. They're changed for different reasons, because different people will not see the same thing, and that's the power of those, you know, the sort of visual theatre.
When you're on stage, what kind of change do you notice in the people who are watching your performance?
I don't notice it when we're on stage. It's what we like to do is to come out at the end and sort of meet the audience afterwards, because obviously we've been on stage for an hour and a half, and then the really exciting bit is to then come out of the theatre and then talk to everyone afterwards about what they've seen, what they've experienced, and how they've experienced it. That's the reward, because then it's a trigger for discussion. Everything is an excuse for discussion, for coming together in the end, regardless of the medium.
Tell us a little bit about your new production called Birth. And you tour great productions all over the world, don't you, often to sell out audiences. So obviously you've got a new one to wheel out. What's that been like putting together?
It's interesting, because now we're getting used to make shows, so we're a little bit more used to opening shows and doing that. So it's but it's the more it gets, the more stressful it becomes, because obviously, and it's like when you do a show, you opening night obviously is very stressful, but then the second night is even more stressful, because are we going to be able to do it again? Are we going to be able to raise to that level? Are we going to be able to make it all happen as if it was the first time, as if we'd never done it before? And every time we perform, obviously the pressure is even heavier, because are we going to be able to do it again? And so same thing for the show. Are we going to be able to make another show? Are we going to be able to move the audience, to transport them again?
What is Birth about?
It's about three women. It's about Sue, Catherine and Emily, a grandmother, a mother and a daughter, three women from the same family. And it's about a secret that they share and how they discover that secret and the effect that it has on them, and how they come to terms with that secret. So it's an exploration of family secret. It's an exploration of what is it that is being passed down from one generation to the other. It's an exploration of where does memory and when does memory begin. So yeah, we're exploring all of that.
It sounds amazing, but quite a challenge to do every single night.
Yeah.
Good fun. One thing that your organisation does, your company does, is it holds workshops for people. You can sign up for weekend workshops in the next few weeks. If you happen to be in London and you fancy being a gymnast, an actor and a poet all in one, you can sign up with Theatre Ray. What kind of people come along, and what do they want from a big workshop with your company?
Do you know what? It's a really exciting question, because obviously we get actors, professional actors or semi-professional actors who sort of want to train and develop a new skill. But excitingly enough, we also get architects, we also get painters, we also get sculptors. So we get different people who just want to have a look at a body in space, people who just want to think differently about their body and how to use it. And that's really exciting, because then it means that the people that are there to get, you know, a new skill, like the actors that are there to get a new skill, or the circus performers or the dancers, I mean the performers in general, look at it from a very different point of view, because there's people with a completely different perspective, and I think it enriches everything. So I often get email when we do a workshop from people, because obviously I say, you know, this is for professional performers, but then I receive a lot of emails saying, yeah, well, I'm not a performer, but I'm doing this, and I, you know, can I join? And I say yes, of course, because it will enrich everyone's journey. So that's the exciting bit. And because, to be fair, everyone is a beginner. You know, there isn't. And actually, the more of a beginner you are, I think you're the better off you, because then you don't have to sort of clear everything. You're starting from scratch, and I think it's much better.
And what do you learn during your workshops?
Well, I think, you know, if someone learns a lot, it's the most. It's probably me, because I think when you see what people are doing, you are able to correct, you are able to move forward. So it's much easier, and that's why, you know, I like directing, because it's much easier, at least for me, it's much easier to see, and then I can bounce off it and give the solution. When you're in it, I think that the job of an actor or a student training is incredibly difficult, because you're in it and you can analyse and do at the same time. They're two different processes. So when I'm looking at it from the outside, it's just very exciting, because I get to see, I get to give the key or some of the key, and then I get to see them opening the door, and that's incredibly rewarding. I think there's an enormous amount of joy to be found in making people play in that way.
What do you mean by making people play? So imagine you come to one of your workshops and you're talking about directing people and asking them to, you know, push themselves out of their usual space. What are the lessons entail? What are you teaching people to do? I mean, you're not teaching them to be a man stuck in a box, for example.
No, and I don't know how to do that, unfortunately. but I think first of all, we're going to learn how to move like gods. You know, if you were going to go to, you know, like, let's say Radha, for instance, a very big drama school, people would train you how to speak like gods. Well, what we do is, like, we teach them how to move, how to stand, how to be, how to be ready for action, how to be ready to fall in love, to kill someone. It doesn't really matter. It's just to be ready for action, so that you might not fall in love, you might not kill anyone, but at least you're ready. And then when you step on stage, people think, oh God, I don't know what's going to happen, but something is about to happen. Yeah, I often say, you know, it's like watching a cat chasing a mouse. You know, we've all seen that. And if there was a mouse in the studio right there and a cat, you know, chasing it, we would be watching, even though we know what's going to happen. It's either going to catch the mouse or not, or fall in love with it. But I mean, it's unlikely. But, you know, we know what's going to happen. What we're going to look out for is how it's going to happen. And that's why I train people, is the how they're going to fall in love, how they're going to kill someone. And all of that is physical. All of that is visual. All of that is through actions, through images, because it's direct.
One thing that when you're talking, it reminded me of the French artist Christine and the Queens, and she's a pop star in many respects, but at the same time, every iteration that she goes through involves a dance troupe who she is part of, and they act scenarios, and a lot of her shows are about mime. When you see someone like Christine and the Queens, do you think, brilliant, this is mime without being explicitly shown as mime, actually be going into the mainstream culture, and people might embrace mime as an art form itself a little bit more?
I think it's brilliant. To be fair, you know, again, going back to what we were saying earlier, I think it doesn't really matter what you use. The aim is to communicate. The aim is to reach people. The aim is to touch them. So when we do our show, I don't think our show is a mime show. For instance, there's live music in a theatre show. Yeah, no, we're using anything from Stanislavski to Etienne de Crewe, and it doesn't matter. What matters is the communication, and no matter the tools, you know. Of course, when you're training, you know, you're training in Cunningham, you're training in Graham, you're doing release, you're doing mime, you're doing, you know. I think it's important to know what you're learning, the tool that you're learning. But once you're making a show, like, you know, you just mentioning Christine and the Queen, you're using everything you can to communicate what you have to communicate. So when we make a piece of work, we're not serving an aesthetic, we're serving a message, we're serving something that we need to communicate, and it doesn't matter. We're going to use absolutely everything to communicate. For instance, in Birth, so I'm also a magician, and it, Birth is not a magic show, but there is an element of magic to it, in the way that things appear and disappear on stage, in the way that we play with darkness and light, in the way that that the whole piece is constructed. But I don't want people to go out like, to go out of the theatre and think, oh, it was a great trick. People should not notice. They should not be seen. They should be taken on a journey and be surprised. The moment they start thinking about the mechanics, you've lost half of them.
The London International Mime Festival begins this week on Wednesday. You're one of several groups who are doing performances. What are you most excited about seeing as a spectator?
Absolutely everything. It's the one festival I look out for all year. I'm definitely going to see Backup, the company from Belgium. They're coming on the third week of the festival, I think. And then there's another company, a French company actually, Théâtre de l'Entrouvert, and they're coming at the Barbican the third week as well. So I'm really looking forward to those.
And you mentioned the fact that it is it's a French company that's coming to the Barbican. The question has to be asked, what is it about the French brain or body that makes it its citizens the leading exponents of mime?
I don't think it's true. I've trained with, obviously, a French woman, Corinne Soum, but also her husband, Stephen Wasson, and they were the former assistants of Etienne de Crewe. I think, obviously, you had very strong masters in the 20th century, you know, starting with Jacques Copeau and going into, you know, Jacques Lecoq, Etienne de Crewe, and, you know, obviously, Marcel Marceau, all these people were based in France. But then a lot of international students came in terms of second generation, and, you know, Americans, British people came. And so now if you want to train, you need to learn with people that actually are not French. So and it doesn't, and I think it's great because it brings a different outlook. So I don't think it's just a French anymore. I think if you want to train, you have to travel. You have to find the master, and they're not all in France, which is exciting. It sort of enriches everything.
In fact, the masters and mistresses of mime will be in London from this Wednesday with the International Mime Festival. Guillaume Piget, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24. Théâtre Ré is taking part in the festival from next Wednesday. Still to come on Monocle 24, why classical music is getting the crowds roaring. We hear a good read and we get the weekend papers too. Stay with us.
See that man sitting opposite you on the subway, lost in another world? Or that smart woman scribbling notes while having her flat white? Well, here's what links them. They're both listening to Monocle 24 via our free radio app that simply and seamlessly lets you tune in live or download shows for later enjoyment. Just think, you too could be settling back enjoying cultural nourishment in the form of the Monocle Arts Review, being briefed on the world of business with the entrepreneurs, or just enjoying great music with the sessions at Midori House. Come on, download the Monocle 24 app today, stick on your headphones, and have informed fun on the go. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
It's 10:20 here in London, if you've only just joined us. A very warm welcome to Monocle 24. It's Emma Nelson here with a live edition of Sunday Brunch, the first of 2019. And we live in a world now where you can hear almost any piece of music ever recorded at any time, day or night, wherever you may be. As a result, old boundaries and blocks are thankfully fast disappearing, and this is leading to more and more people listening to classical music. But to some, it's still pretty elitist, especially when it comes to live performances, where you might not be sure what to do or even when to applaud. So step in the cellist Adam Szabo in the city of Manchester in the north of England. He's brought together a new group of classical musicians called the Manchester Collective, and the group is helping music to reach fresh audiences. They're doing it by playing in nightclubs and gig venues alongside more conventional concert halls. Adam spoke to Monocle's Paul Osborne.
Both my parents come from the classical music world. My dad is a cellist, and I actually started my career as an orchestral cellist, playing at the highest level, I guess, in this country. And one of my really fond memories from my childhood was of my dad kind of sitting me down next to the piano and introducing me to these great pieces of music for the first time. And the way that he spoke about them was so passionate, and there was always a story, and it was kind of getting you behind the notes and behind these classic recordings to kind of paint this vivid picture of this incredible music. And it's something that really stayed with me. And I think in our shows that we produce now, it's something that we really try and think about, is how can we communicate our own love for this music and this rep to an audience that, you know, potentially we've never met before. The vibe that we try and create is almost as if someone that you care about is sharing something with you that they really love.
And it's one of the strange things is that as particularly as classical music sort of expands and attracts a new audience, but more people are listening perhaps than ever have been before. But sometimes you get the feeling that for a lot of people, it is basically a form of background music, and all of that stuff about the stories and the inspirations that are behind it don't necessarily come out. And so it maybe is a challenge to actually take that to people who are only just beginning to get into it.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a tremendous opportunity here because I guess we have this whole new generation of listeners who are, you know, tuned into this station and Spotify listeners, and they don't listen in kind of a genre-based way. And so I think when kind of I plug in my streaming service, I mean, I'm not kind of looking at, you know, saying, oh, I'm going to listen to prog rock today for 3 hours, or I'm going to listen to Baroque classical music for 3 hours today. You kind of listen to playlists and all sorts of different influences from all over the place. And so we have a bigger audience than ever before that are potentially receptive to this really new, really old, excellent kind of wide-ranging repertoire of music. And the challenge for us in this business is that we've gotten generally, I think, very lazy in the way that we speak about classical music to new audiences, because we've had 200 years of the good life preaching to the choir, people that are already in the club, already patrons, already classical music goers. And of course, it's very easy to talk to those people about classical music. For us, the big challenge and the big opportunity is how to share this stuff with people who are new to the game, and how to give them sort of a bit of a taster of something that will hopefully be sort of a passion that they come back to over the course of a lifetime.
And part of that, I suppose, is that decision to take it out of the traditional environment of the concert hall and this kind of thing, and trying to sort of go where they are almost.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, we do both. We play in some of the biggest concert halls in the country, and then we also play these off-the-grid, underground, really alternative concerts. We just did a series of shows at this notorious nightclub in Salford called The White Hotel. It's an ex-MOT garage next to a prison, and you have to go down this quite murdery back street to get into the venue. And I think that's the other thing, is this kind of feeling of discovery when our audiences get there and they see that the stage is set with lights and haze and there's a bar and there's already kind of music on, there's kind of a really exciting atmosphere. And then these world-class players come on and it feels like you've discovered something that is almost kind of a secret society or something that is a really exclusive experience. And the reason that we don't exclusively play in these bigger heritage venues is that I think for this younger audience, it's not always everything about that traditional experience is particularly appealing, actually. You know, you walk in and, of course, this is worst case scenario, but, you know, you're surrounded by people who are 40 years your senior. It's beige carpets, it's expensive drinks, it's kind of strip lighting. It's not really the recipe for a good time.
Well, there's also that assumption, isn't there? I've been to quite a lot of these kind of concerts where there might be a bar, but you're then expected to sit in absolute silence for 2.5 hours. And there's one of the strangest, if someone's performing a long piece, saying four movements or something, there's the absolute terror that somebody claps at the wrong time, that you clap in between a movement, then everyone glares at you because you've committed some terrible faux pas.
Yeah, it's very, very easy to confuse that silence in a concert hall with reverence. And a lot of the time what that silence is, as you say, fear and terror at doing the wrong thing at the wrong time, or, you know, this kind of social pressure that you have to now sit there and be quiet for 90 minutes and at the end we get some polite applause and people can leave. I mean, what's interesting is that we play at these quite different spaces, and a lot of the time we achieve a very similar effect, you know, in these kind of loud, bustling venues where normally people are kind of ordering drinks and walking around and partying. You know, when you start playing something that casts this musical spell, that music is very powerful and people are quiet and you can hear a pin drop. And then when the music is done, what's incredible is that people feel able to express how much they kind of loved the show. We played this sensational Michael Gordon piece at a show recently where It's a solo cello piece where the cello feed is fed through a vintage Ibanez Tube Screamer distortion pedal. And it's basically, it's a 10-minute piece. It's like a 10-minute crescendo. The music just gets louder and louder and louder until you're overwhelmed by this incredible wall of sound. It's a super intense experience. We finished this piece, you know, and it's like you've just been hit by a tidal wave. And this guy in the front row just stood up and was like, "That was fucking awesome!" I think that's what we're really going for, is just genuine, radical human experiences that we can create through this music.
So looking ahead to 2019, you mentioned that combination of sort of traditional spaces and then these different kind of locations for this type of music, that will carry on through the year.
We've forged a wonderful partnership with Leeds Town Hall, which is one of the kind of incredible heritage spaces in the north of England. We play at concert halls in Nottingham, in Manchester, at the Stoller Hall. And then alongside that line of more traditional concerts that we present, in Liverpool we play at a place called the Invisible Wind Factory, which is a massive warehouse on the docks. They used to manufacture wind turbines there. It's in a really exciting part of town that is being rejuvenated. All of these really exciting artists coming there and making music and creating art together. We're back at the White Hotel in Salford, and then in Hull we play at an old post office in the centre of town that has been abandoned for the last 40 years. We're the first people to play there for nearly half a century, and it's remarkable. It's kind of in the centre of this kind of bustling high street, and then you go through this little gateway and suddenly it looks like you've stepped back in time, and the roof's caving in, there's no power, there's no running water, so we have to bring everything. It's a legit kind of pop-up experience. And, you know, for 90 minutes people come and it's like they're in a different world.
The awesome sound of the Manchester Collective. That was Adam Szabo speaking to Monocle's Paul Osborne. You're listening to Sunday Brunch. A little bit later in the programme, we'll be going through the newspapers with the journalist Vincent McAvinney. But first, time for our regular Sunday brunch feature called Weekend Reads. Ivy Pashoda is the author of the critically acclaimed books The Art of Disappearing and Visitation Street. And she spoke earlier to Monocle's Georgina Godwin, beginning by talking about the setting for her latest book, Wonder Valley.
The desert is a very bleak on the surface landscape that's pretty inhospitable, and a lot of nefarious things go on out there because there's not a lot of eyes on what's going on. But it is incredibly beautiful. The Joshua Tree National Park is one of the most stunning natural landscapes I've ever seen in my entire life. But there's also a lot of poverty and unfortunate things that happen to people who live out there. And Skid Row is the largest homeless community almost in the entire world, or definitely in the entire world. It's in downtown LA, so it is being squeezed by two neighborhoods which are gentrifying, the Arts District and the historic core of downtown. And it's a homeless community where you see traditional homeless lifestyle, people sleeping and camping on the streets. But there's also a great sense of community and joy there that I think a lot of people overlook. So I was interested in examining these two sort of misunderstood places.
Mm-hmm. And how did you come into contact with them? Were you living there? Were you a frequent person visiting?
Well, I lived on the far side of Skid Row in a neighborhood called the Arts District, which is a rapidly gentrifying neighborhood in Los Angeles. I have to admit, I'm part of that movement. But to get there, you had to drive straight through Skid Row. So it's really sandwiched. And I became quite interested in Skid Row because the more time you spend there, the more you notice that it's not just a random jumble of people who fall down and sleep where they fell, but, you know, an organized community with different encampments based around different organizing principles, people from different countries, people who are artists, people who are musicians. There's even a new sign I noticed the other day saying Skid Row Writers Coalition, you know, on the street. So I became quite interested in sort of what that community was like, and I began volunteering teaching creative writing at a community center called the LAMP Arts Program, which is now called Studio 526, in Skid Row. And from there, my novel evolved. And for some reason, I took a little writing vacation in the desert, a cabin out in 29 Palms. And the landscape was so stunning and interesting and strange and creepy that that setting became sort of a part of the book.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that seems to be a theme through your work, doesn't it?
Setting, yeah. It's the most, for me, it's where the story starts. You know, I love landscape and I love setting and I love place. And for me, the first thing I want to write about is the place where I am, and then I try to figure out a group of characters. For the most part, my novels have been multi-perspective, so I'd like to come up with a group of characters that can give a like three-dimensional panorama of the place I'm writing about, so lots of people looking at it from different angles.
Mm-hmm. And in this particular book, in Wonder Valley, you have six main characters, and their lives all intersect. It has an incredibly powerful opening, this vision of a naked person running. Tell us about that.
Well, it is inspired by something I remember happening as a child. Someone I knew tangentially had a breakdown and ran across the Brooklyn Bridge and was hit by a car and killed. And this event was witnessed by various groups of people, and everyone had a different reaction. People who had been with this man, you know, were devastated, and people I knew who were jogging across the bridge were just horrified. So I was interested in the way an event can capture the intention of a city or a neighborhood, but be interpreted differently. I live in Los Angeles now, and the thing that binds everybody, you know, from any economic background is traffic. Everyone who commutes sits in morning traffic, and they all listen, or we all listen, to the traffic report on the radio. So I came up with the idea of an event that sort of tied Los Angeles together would be something that interfered with the morning commute. And so I thought that the naked jogger would be a good way to sort of interfere with the morning commute and give everyone sort of something to react to.
Mm. Now, how would you describe this book in terms of genre?
I mean, I've been told to say crime adjacent because that's sort of what marketing people say. You know, for me, it's literary fiction, whatever that means. I think it has a bit of a crime overtone in the sense that something mysterious has happened and we want to know what it is. But I think that's sort of the case for many novels that don't have death or murder or, you know, mayhem in them. I think it's a literary novel with a mystery at the core, but I think genre is fluid and it can be, it can really be anything, but crime adjacent is what I'll stick with.
And finally, I wanted to ask about your publisher because you have come out, you're only, I think, the second
yes.
book to come out published by Indigo Press.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm so excited. They are a new independent publisher, and I have to say, I grew up in a publishing family, and when I heard someone was starting a publishing company in this day and age, I was so excited to find out more and have my agent submit my book there. They're a great independent publisher of really well-curated, thoughtful books, and it just seems like an amazing project in this day and age to really go back to sort of really thoughtful, really hand-picked writing that also a company that can take the time to really read them and promote them. It's just terrific. I'm really, really excited to be part of it.
Does it make a difference for an American author to be published by a British press?
Yeah, it does, actually. And you would think it would just be the simplest thing in the world because the book is in English and why don't you guys want it? But I think the taste is quite different. I think there's a, you know, there's some books that it just is taken for granted will come out in the UK, you know, really big books. But it is really interesting to see how the taste is slightly different over here. And for me, it's a really big deal because I grew up reading a lot of British authors and a lot of my children's books came out of England. So for me, it's a huge honor, but also it's great to reach a different readership who might not be quite as familiar with sort of the themes and places.
And Wonder Valley is out now. To hear more from Georgina, check out Meet the Rices. You can find the full back catalogue online at monocle.com. Up next, we go through the weekend papers.
Immerse yourself in the world of Monocle. Visit monocle.com. Listen live to our radio station, Monocle 24, or explore more than 5,000 hours of audio. Every minute of every show we've broadcast since we launched. And don't forget that we have over 400 films to watch and share, while magazine subscribers can log in and browse our complete print archive on screen. Our online shop is here too, which you'll find well stocked with clothing, books, travel accessories, fragrances, homewares, and more. Check into monocle.com every day for fresh news and opinion from our editors and bureau around the globe. Then plan a trip to one of those spots for business or pleasure with our handy city and resort guides. It's all there for you at monocle.com. What are you waiting for?
Welcome back to Studio One. It's Emma Nelson here. You're listening to Sunday Brunch on Monocle 24. Let's have a look at the weekend papers. And I'm delighted to say Vincent McAvinney, UK correspondent for Euronews NBC, has been doing all the heavy lifting, as most of us, Vincent, I must confess, have refused to pick up a newspaper for a few times, a few days over Christmas. A lot of us decided, I don't want to read, I don't want to know, I don't want to be scared about anything for a few days. We all went into a slightly food and drink-induced torpor, but you're here to shake us out of it and tell us what's what.
That's right. I think everyone wanted a little break from the news over Christmas. And the news
you
was...
You went to Wales and went up a mountain.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, just to get away. Things are about... It has felt weird this week, though, because of the way New Year's felt. I was working from the 2nd and London has been dead and nothing's really been happening. I think things kickstart tomorrow properly, don't they?
Indeed. I think a lot of us who were also sort of doing a little bit of whatever after on the 2nd of January were just thinking that we need to make a more civilised system here in the United Kingdom, that we should have what's known as a clean break Monday.
Yeah.
So everything gets a holiday until the following Monday after
That's
Christmas, and that
idea.
Way we're
yeah.
fine. It won't yeah. be economically damaging at all to the United Kingdom, because nothing's going to happen this year that could remotely threaten the British
no.
economy, is it, Vincent?
That's a nice segue into Brexit, oh. which starts again this week. There are now 11 weeks until the United Kingdom leaves the European Union.
That's just giving me
Union
palpitations.
After decades, yep. And it all kicks off. The suspended vote that should have happened before Christmas on Theresa May's deal will happen next week at some point on the 14th, 15th or 16th. It's not entirely clear yet, but there will be another 5 full days of debate up until that point. So in the papers today, lots of talk about what the Prime Minister has been doing over the holidays. The person I think to always go to at the moment is Tim Shipman in the Sunday Times. He is a man who always knows what's going on in Whitehall. Now, the Prime Minister has been using the Christmas break to try and phone European leaders to try and get more from them. Specifically, we think she's after what's called a codicil, which is a legal text to her withdrawal agreement, which would say that the backstop, which is the arrangement in place to stop a hard border in Northern Ireland at the end of the transition period, should no deal be agreed in that time, that it would be time limited to around a year. So that is what she is after. You're looking confused about that.
Have you just seen? I'm just sort of rubbing my face with sort of bafflement. We've just launched into that thing that I'd forgotten that Brexit is so prone to doing, which is inventing or using rules and regulations and things which the general public is normally protected from to twist, turn, bifurcate and wriggle around. And you've just given us another example of another thing that the Prime Minister is trying to use to make happen. So do apologise if I did shut my eyes and rub my forehead in confusion.
It's quite all right.
I wonder whether anybody else listening out there is going, I have no idea what Vincent has just said, but I'm not going to be polite enough to say we didn't get that.
Do you need an explainer?
Well, is it really going to matter? Because is it going to work?
Because,
is it going to get us
yeah,
any closer to Brexit?
This is the thing. When the vote was meant to happen before Christmas, Theresa May and Number 10 had done a count, and there was looking like 140 of her own MPs were going to vote against her, and it wouldn't get through. Now, some of those were the kind of hardcore Brexiteers that just want no deal, so they'll wreck whatever she puts down. Some were specifically worried about the Northern Irish backstop. So that is a agreement that has been made whereby there won't be a border put between the Republic and Northern Ireland or in the Irish Sea. But with the with Ireland and the UK staying aligned to the rules of the EU. So what some MPs are worried about is that we would be kind of perpetually caught in this limbo as negotiations went on of a situation where the UK was still kind of trapped within the confines of the EU. I think that's the simplest way to explain it, basically. But what we'll see over the next couple of days is the debate in Parliament. And Tim Shipman's got a good story that Yvette Cooper, who is a kind of senior Labour backbench MP, she's the head of the Home Affairs Select Committee, is looking at doing a US-style government shutdown here in the UK, because there happens to be a finance bill going through the House of Commons, and she apparently is leading a group who are going to put some amendments on it on Thursday, which would leave Whitehall, which is the government street with all the departments on it here in London, in a lockdown because the Treasury would not be able to release funds to different departments. So we've never really had anything like this in the UK,
this
and it would be quite fascinating.
This is holding the government to
ransom. This is, yeah, and in order to prevent,
she wants
to, apparently the government, sources in the government are saying it would cause total paralysis. And this is to hold the Prime Minister's feet against the fire opposed to the hardcore Brexiteers ERG group, that no deal is not an option. That this we've heard from Ken Clark, that someone else popping up in the paper today, the kind of father of the house, the longer serving MP. He's a Conservative but pro-European, and he has said that the time has now come to pause Article 50. So if the vote doesn't happen, if Theresa May can't get her deal through, I think the calls will really grow for Article 50 to be paused whilst we figure out what happens. Because at that point, the Prime Minister is either going to have to try and get more from Europe and try and bring it back, because remember, she's safe from her own party now having a vote of confidence in her for another year. Parliament could try and bring a motion of no confidence, but Labour seem reluctant to do that at the moment because they don't want to do it and lose. So then we would either have Theresa May getting something and coming back, or push towards the second referendum.
What baffles me with this is the insistence by many Brexiteers is that Brexit is going to allow the United Kingdom to forge new relationships, break new barriers, and you know, be a leading light in the world in trade and international relations and what have you. But you work for a company which broadcasts to Europe, to the French principally, and also for NBC, to the United States. What effect does this confusion and mess and gerrymandering have on the United Kingdom's image towards the rest of the world? If you can't organise a departure properly without doing it spitefully, how can you possibly hope to go to another country and say, hey, let's do a deal?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I think British government is globally seen as being pretty stable. We have a system whereby the executive is very powerful compared to other systems. You know, it's not co-equal branches of government. If you are in power and you have a majority, the last Prime Minister to do so was Gordon Brown and Tony Blair, you have a real control over Parliament and things. And then we had the coalition government with the Lib Dems and the Conservatives. That was seen as, for Britain, being a bit unstable, very European. We hadn't had coalition government for decades. And now, yeah, I think, as evidenced by a story that's in The Observer today, this story just kind of sums it up. It's about Ramsgate. So the UK has a port in Dover, which goes to Calais in France. It's geographically, it's basically at the basin of these cliffs. So geographically, it's locked in. It's very hard to expand it. And they are having to do, as it's written in the paper, they're going to have to do a practice soon where they'll have to hire 150 lorries and do an operation where they stack them down the motorway hard shoulder because of the delays that they think will happen at this port. So they're looking for alternatives. That is Ramsgate, which is another town in Kent, which they're having to start. It's a good report from Nasheen Iqbal. So they're dredging the sea base there to try and build a bigger port. But the company that they've awarded a £13.8 million contract to, this is 11 weeks to go, remember, is called Seaborne Freight. Now, Seaborne Freight doesn't have any ferries.
It also doesn't have an address either.
And it also copied its terms and conditions from a fast food delivery company on its website.
Yeah.
And the boss of this company was found to have also had a sort of a little bit of a sketchy business practice with, a past company having huge debts. So it is, it just shows. And of course, it's Chris Grayling, who is the transport secretary, who has a sort of pretty bad reputation in the UK for having not been very good as justice secretary, having caused real problems in the prison service. And now in transport, you know, he's the man when the drone thing is going on, when the trains are messing up. Chris Grayling is always there, and he's not sort of widely respected, is the best way of putting it. And he has awarded this company to this contract to them, but they don't even have a ferry and they don't operate anything. So the idea that we can be ready to do this in 11 weeks is looking pretty sketchy at the moment.
So effectively, what you're describing there, and this is what I've been trying to studiously avoid for the last few weeks, is the coverage of the way the United Kingdom is attempting to deal with a no-deal Brexit. The fact is that our headlines have been dominated over the Christmas period by the idea of not just a no-deal Brexit, but a Brexit where we're having to pretend to stack. We're having to pretend that no one can get through the port of Dover. Mm-hmm. We're having to create a new port out of nothing.
It's entirely damage control. That the no-deal preparations are short-term damage control whilst we try and negotiate stuff. And it's whether or not the public will have the patience to put up with things predicted, like food shortages, medicine shortages, medical supply shortages, having to use RAF planes to fly those kind of things around the country, having problems going through airports, through ferry terminals. That is what we're trying, the next 11 weeks will be about if Theresa May can't get this vote through in the next week.
And what is the purpose of this on the world stage? I'm just thinking in terms of, if you rehearse for a catastrophe very publicly, one wonders whether that catastrophe is inevitable. because what you do is you play out, you show what's going to play out, or whether this is a technique that is being used either well or badly to say, this is what could happen, and you scare people.
Yeah, it'll definitely be being used to, I mean, they have to, any responsible government will have to make preparations for all kinds of eventualities. All governments do all kinds of things. They have plans for chemical attacks and cyber attacks and all these things. So they're making plans for this. But of course, it plays into Theresa May's hands with her own MPs to say, "Do you really want to be responsible for your local hospital running out of medicine when this scenario happens because you haven't voted through my deal, the only one we're ever going to get?" It's definitely going to play to her hands. She can't overdo it because then she'll be accused of Project Fear. But I think Brexit has always seemed very much like this far away, distant thing that was, we had time to worry about it or whatever. But it is swiftly going to become a reality. 11 weeks is not a very long period. And I think especially the time it falls, winter being quite a harsh time. If you think back to last February when we had huge snowfalls in the UK, a couple of days of snow led to huge dips in growth in that quarter. And that was just snow in parts of the country blocking transport.
Tell us something non-Brexit related, Vincent.
Anyway, get away from non-Brexit.
That's all I can... more my poor stomach can take this week, I think.
Definitely as well, just on final point Brexit, some good coverage in The Observer about the difficulty that Jeremy Corbyn finds himself in with his poll rating sliding because there is still a really big muddle about what Labour is going to do. He refuses to back the second referendum, even though it is party policy to support one, with Remain being an option. And Jeremy Hunt in the FT, he's done a little tour of Southeast Asia this week, talking about how Britain in the future will be an invisible chain linking the democracies of the world. And that's come into a bit of criticism.
I'm doing that face rubbing thing again.
Yeah, because he was in Singapore, which itself has been led by one party since independence in 1956, and 10 countries in the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, include some of the world's longest ruling leaders, such as in Brunei, the Communist Party dominating in Vietnam, military governments in Thailand, and shaping things in Myanmar. So it's about how much will Britain do to try and forge new links and turn a blind eye to certain aspects of countries which don't uphold the values of Britain?
Has that ever stopped us before?
Yeah, well, we shall see. But anyway, getting away from Brexit, look at the race to succeed Donald Trump in the White House.
It's
already started.
We're back again.
2020. And the first off the mark on New Year's Day was Elizabeth Warren, the former professor who I think people sort of came to the fore under Obama because she created the Consumer Protection Unit in America. She was kind of instrumental in designing the rules that regulate US banks and what lending and leverage they can do now. She decided to kind of take the mantle of, I'm going to get the first out there, talking about how she is from, a normal working class, middle class background. She kind of raised herself up with community college, how the American dream has died somewhere away along her lifetime. And she will be one of an incredibly crowded field of up to 20 Democrats who are going to make this run, with at the moment no clear favourite whatsoever.
One thing that she's been highlighted doing this week, though, is keeping it real. She's not just the first Democrat candidate. She's the first online beer-drinking Democrat candidate. What's happening there?
That's right. This is a new trend started by Instagram. Basically of Instagram stories, which are kind of short videos that you can put up, and they're 15 seconds long, but you can link them so you can show yourself doing all kinds of stuff, but you can also broadcast live directly to your followers. So there's been a lot of talk in the US about how Donald Trump basically has a state media organization. What do Democrats have? Because they have, of course, CNN and NBC and those kind of things, MSNBC, but they are journalists, balanced and critical. This is politicians broordcasting live themselves. So Beto O'Rourke was the champion of this. He's the guy who ran against Ted Cruz in Texas and almost beat him. He is heavily tipped to make a big run for the 2020, possibly as a VP to Joe Biden. And he is the master of this, broadcasting all kinds of stuff, showing you him cooking recipes with his kids, out campaigning. And then one of the new congresswomen, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez from, I think she's the Bronx. She's the youngest woman ever to serve in Congress. She's younger than I am, which makes me feel a little bit old. But she has also been doing this. She has been broadcasting live, directly talking to her followers to get them out and to support her.
I can't wait. Vincent McAvaney, thank you very much indeed.
20 months until
there's
the election
lot,
or so.
A lot of stuff to watch.
Yeah.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to Sunday Brunch and the time here in London is 10:52. Finally, after the excesses of the holiday period, you'd think we at Monocle 24 would like to embrace a bit of clean living. A portion of kale, perhaps. Tofurkey, a boxing class. No, we're still enjoying ourselves, and this week we're embracing apple brandy. 30 and 40 is a new Calvados brand, which is arriving in the United Kingdom. Apple brandy traditionally is made in the Calvados region of Normandy, but the drink is becoming more and more popular. And one of the co-founders of 30 and 40, Vincent Bejot, spoke to Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
We started a bit like out of passion, this project, because being from Normandy, I was always proud of Calvados and always a bit frustrated not to see Calvados, the Calvados we had in Normandy, in Paris, and even outside of France. So we started just like trying a lot of Calvados, bringing some Calvados back to Paris, where Aymeric, Thibault and I were living. And then try to make experiments, try to create some recipes. And at some point, like, we made some good cocktail bars, tried the product. And at some point, like, a bar called Le Syndicat in Paris, one of the world best bar, and which is specialized in French spirit, they called us and they say, listen, Vincent, your product is on our next menu, so I need to have like 3 cases by next week. I didn't know what to say because I didn't have anything, any bottle. So we said yes, and then we just started to sell our products to bartenders and to restaurants and then to wine cellars. And then I started to go to London to meet people there. And that's basically how it started.
And as a drink, what do you like about Calvados? There's quite a long tradition in the region of Normandy. I was reading a little bit
Of course.
About, I mean, it's been centuries, actually.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. It's kind of hard to date, but Normandy is known as a terroir for being one of the oldest and the best terroir for growing apples, and especially cider apples. So we've been making cider in Normandy for maybe forever. And then we started distilling around like 400 years ago. And so it's actually a very long tradition. What we love about Calvados is that it's still a very small category, which has been always put aside and considered as a farmer product compared to other categories, which had much more capitalistic intensity. For example, cognac has always been an export product. And today, cognac represents a market of around 200 million bottles a year. 98% of each is exported, while Calvados is a very small market. It's still a 6 million bottles market, so it's very, very tiny and traditional products category. And there's still a lot to discover. Our mission at 1340 is to fight for the diversity of Calvados, is to show to people that Calvados is an extremely diverse and rich category worth be discovered.
Oh, and that's what you're doing with your products. I mean,
exactly.
You have 6 different ones, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Shall we go through a couple of them?
And
maybe I'll even try some of them?
Yeah, yeah. I brought them for this reason, actually. So I guess a good way to start for you would be to try this first product, which is 30 et 40 cider eau de vie. So be careful, it's 45% ABV, so it's quite a strong product. So to make Calvados, you make cider, and then you distill cider, then you need to age it 2 years. So what you're actually trying is not proper Calvados because it hasn't been aged, it's what you have right after the distillation process. So it's a clear spirits compared to Calvados, which the aging gives a bit of color. What's interesting with the cider eau de vie is that it's really a photography of the terroir and of the fruits you're using. So you can't hide defaults of an eau de vie because you can correct those defaults with the aging. It needs to be like extremely good.
I love the initial taste, I have to say. And of course, it's quite strong, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
But yeah, amazing, the first taste.
Thank you. This is a blend, actually, of 2 cider eau de vies. So we have 2 ranges of products. We have a range of blended products. To make these products, we have a very specific idea in mind of the tasting profile we're looking for. And then we have this idea in mind, and then we go around Normandy and we visit Calvados producers to source those ingredients we're looking for our blends. So this is what you're trying. It's a blend of cider eau de vie from southwest Normandy, which has been distilled once in a column still, which gives you a lot of fruitiness, a lot of tension. The other spirit is cider eau de vie from Calvados Pays d'Auge, which has been double distilled in a pot still. And this gives you a bit more texture, a bit more spices as well. So by blending both, we're able to find the right balance of what we were looking for.
So you're here in London, for example. So are you talking about with some retailers or restaurants?
Yeah, well, sure.
If somebody's interested in your product, where are they able to find?
Well, we work with some of the best cocktail bars in the city and in the world, because London is a very famous place in the world for its cocktail bars. So, for example, we work with the Savoy. We work with Happiness Forgets. We work with some bars called Three Sheets. Lots of other quite innovative bars. And then we work with wine cellars like Whiskey Exchange and with some other wine shops like Jerry's, Soho Wine Supply, for example. Mm. This kind of people.
Can you suggest perhaps, you know, it's winter times, getting cold, something, a cozy, nice cocktail that we can make with Calvados? A little tip for our listeners.
Yeah, of course. Well, we have actually our last product, which is kind of our main focus, actually, which is a Calvados-based aperitif. Mm. And if you want to try it?
I would like to try it. Why not?
It's actually much smoother. And it's 23% ABV, so it's a blend of Calvados and cider apple juice.
Mm.
So we reduce the ABV by putting some cider apple juice. So the Calvados kills the fermentation of the cider apple juice, so we keep the sugar from the apples. It's very smooth and it's not too sweet. We really try to work on the balance between the ABV and the sugar, so it's not syrupy, you know. So it's very truthful to Calvados with being a bit more approachable. And typically, you could enjoy this in the winter on its own over ice, for example, even neat after dinner. Or we do have some like very simple cocktails, for example, with ginger ale. I would say ginger ale for winter and, for example, tonic during the summer. This is the kind of easy cocktails you can make at home, which makes the product very approachable.
Vincent Bejo talking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco. That's all we have time for this edition of Sunday Brunch. Thank you very much for your company. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. Goodbye.